Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
A rally to protest last week's election in Kenya was called off today after supporters of opposition leader Raila Odinga were prevented from getting to the protest site in Nairobi after clashes with police. Odinga has charged that President Mwai Kibaki stole the election and has rejected Kibaki's claim of victory. The Kenya Human Rights Commission and the Kenyan Attorney General have both called for an independent review of the disputed ballot results. An estimated 300 people have been killed in the last week, including as many as 50 people burned to death in a church that was set on fire, and as many as 100,000 people have been displaced. This violence and political unrest has created a crisis in one of Africa's most stable democracies and ignited ethnic rivalries. Joel Barkan was an international election observer in Kenya. He returned to the States on Sunday. He joins us this morning on Radio Times. He's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, also professor emeritus at the University of Iowa. And Joel Barkan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Is there someone or some group that you think can mediate this crisis in Kenya?
Well, mediation has actually perhaps begun. A group of prominent Kenyans stepped forward about 2 days ago and suggested that Bishop Desmond Tutu be brought in for mediation. They contacted him. He agreed, and he is already in Kenya now and met with one of the principals, Raila Odinga, this morning.
And will he be meeting with the president sometime soon?
I have no direct knowledge, but it would be hard for President Kibaki not to meet with someone of the stature of Desmond Tutu.
And how do you think this can be resolved?
There are really only two ways to resolve this. First, as indicated in your lead-in piece, a audit of the elections. This was first called for by the EU delegation a couple of days back, and that is to say an international audit, and now the Kenyan Human Rights Commission and evidently the Attorney General, which surprises me a little bit,
really?
Have come on board. That is certainly the first thing to do because there is a paper trail here, and the problem occurred not in the voting but in the count. And therefore, if the reporting sheets from the individual polling stations can be assembled, it is still possible to have a proper count of this election and determine who won. Secondly, though, events have really, I think, almost gone past the count. Count would certainly make the winner legitimate, but Kenya is divided politically. Whomever wins, roughly 50-50. And that means, in this case, that probably the best step in the short term is a government of national unity, and perhaps Desmond Tutu can, in fact, broker that with international pressure for such, supporting him by the EU, the United States, and the UK.
Let me talk to you a bit about the election since you were there as an observer. What's the job of an observer, and where could you go?
Well, the job of an observer is just what the word implies, to watch how the electoral process unfolds and report on it. The job of an observer is not to interfere with the process, even if he or she observes irregularities. If observers are treated as they're supposed to be treated, they are free to go anywhere, and that was certainly the case in my case. I was part of the observer delegation mounted by the International Republican Institute and supported by the National Endowment for Democracy. We were actually a group of short-term observers in country for only a week. The EU had a much larger delegation of about 30 long-term observers who were there from early November on, and then supplemented by 90 short-term observers the week of the election. So the most rigorous observation encompasses the run-up to the election, that is the campaign period, the registration of voters, etc., and then the more short-term period is what happens on election day, the count and the reporting of the count.
As you said, the problem seems to have come from the reporting of the accounts?
Correct.
Of the votes?
Correct.
So from your observation, and it seemed as if many people did go to the polls to vote, that they were not impeded in their willingness to vote for a president or parliament?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the best things about this elections, compared to previous elections in Kenya, that is the last three multi-party elections, is first and foremost, there really was a level playing field this time between all the candidates at both the parliamentary and presidential level, and that was wonderful to behold. There were some problems with the development of the register, but the campaign was open. And a tremendous amount of money, I might add, was spent on this by the principals for the presidency. On the day before the election, there were some problems in the deployment of the ballots and materials to the polling stations, but for the most part, all polling stations opened on time or just slightly late. The polls were to open at 6 a.m. I witnessed the opening of the polls in Nakuru, a town about 90 miles west of Nairobi, and they opened at 6:15. That's not really late, and that was much better than previous the three previous multi-party elections. People were free to vote. It was very moving. I photographed lines of people, perhaps three city blocks long, patiently waiting up to 3 or 4 hours to exercise their rights. And frankly, Americans should have been there to witness that.
To observe that as well. Do you know what the voting turnout was? What percentage of the voting population actually went to the polls?
Well, I can give you the percentage of the registered voters. That was approximately 72%.
Wow.
Higher than in the U.S. In some areas, it was as high as the low 90s. It basically ranged from 50% to the low 90s of those registered.
Does that tell you what Kenyans think about democracy or thought about this particular election, that they were so willing to go out and, as you say, wait patiently in line to cast their vote?
Well, they have turned out in large numbers in previous elections, but this one was particularly high, I believe, because the contest at the presidential level was so close. There were a series of public opinion polls in Kenya going back about 4 months before the election, or perhaps even more, since July, and they initially showed Raila Odinga with a substantial lead, but as we drew closer to the elections, they basically predicted a dead heat.
Wow.
So either side had tremendous incentive to turn out their supporters. In fact, the election in many ways turned on turnout, and that's exactly what happened.
As you mentioned, there is a paper trail. Are those votes protected somewhere so that if there is an effort to actually recount them, that they will all be there?
The votes themselves do not need to be recounted. What happened at the polling station is, first of all, they use paper ballots. It's a slow process. They use three separate ballots, one for president, one for parliament, and one for local government. And for each of those races, the presiding officer literally held up the paper ballot for everybody to see, including the party agents of the different competing parties, and they were put in separate piles for the various candidates, and then they were counted twice and put on a form. It's that reporting form which is posted at the polling station and then signed by all the party agents, which made the count legitimate, that then is forwarded, because there are multiple copies made, forwarded to the headquarters at each constituency and then on to Nairobi.
Hmm.
And it was in that forwarding that forms got lost, that forms were photocopied without the signatures, but the party agents have these forms. So people step forward with their copies of the forms. There's a paper trail. They don't have to go back to the ballots themselves, although they are there, presumably sealed in the ballot boxes that were used for each polling station.
Why do you think this particular election seemed to unleash some ethnic rivalries and hostilities?
Well, first of all, Kenyan elections, going back all the way to 1963, have been contests between people residing in different parts of the country who happen to be members of different ethnic groups. They are mobilized at times on the basis of ethnicity, at times simply on the basis of where they live, because in an agrarian society, most people want the same things. That is to say, they want water, they want schools constructed, they want health clinics, they want roads to their particular village. So it's not initially really an issue of ethnicity. It's a matter of our part of the country versus yours. But that coincides with ethnicity, and often, therefore, if an area believes that it's been neglected by a government, the ethnic card is brought into play. And that's what happened in this election, perhaps even more so than in previous elections, because, as I indicated, the election was close, and also because it is important to remember here that Raila Odinga, the challenger in this election, had been not only part of President Kibaki's government, he basically won the election for Kibaki in 2002 when Kibaki became a president. And then they fell out because an agreement on the allocation of government positions before the election was essentially not implemented by President Kibaki. He basically welched on the political deal, and that's where the two fell apart. But there's no real ideological difference between the two. Raila Odinga is painted as a populist. Some even go so far to say he's a socialist. He's not for the state management of the economy. He's perhaps he came out for a greater devolution of power to the local areas to ensure a more equal distribution of central government revenues across Kenya. But he's hardly a radical. He's rather a very shrewd politician who was able to mobilize most of the country that is against the current government. That is to say, he won a majority in all areas except Central Province, which is the home province of President Kibaki. So Kibaki wins 90% in one area, in his own area, and Odinga wins most of the rest by much smaller amounts.
Several questions, and we have to say goodbye in about a minute and a half. But would you say then the conflict between these two political leaders is personal because of their falling out?
Well, unfortunately, it's become personal, but hopefully that will be bridged. One of the unique, you know, there have been cries that Kenya may drift into civil war, and it is not unthinkable, and I think it's good to keep that fear there, because in the wake of this election, elites who are not members not part of the leadership of either of these parties, and a very eloquent editorial, by the way, in the Daily Nation, Kenya's principal paper, basically said, look, we have a stable and prosperous country that is an example to much of the rest of Africa, and we cannot lose this. And so cooler heads are beginning to prevail. All these people know each other. They know each other on a first-name basis. That's true of Raila and Mwai Kibaki, and it's they've had some rough relationships over the last 5 years, but if cooler heads can prevail, perhaps they can get back together again, if for no other reason than to, say, divide power in the short term and stay out of each other's way. That is, each would run their respective parts of the government.
Well, Joel Barkan, I appreciate you. I know you've been very busy, and I appreciate you joining us in this portion of Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Nice to be with you.
And that's Joel Barkan, Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, also Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa, and he returned on Sunday after being an international observer of the Kenyan election, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. We've got two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra and music director Christoph Eschenbach celebrate the music of Leonard Bernstein at the 2008 Bernstein Festival, January 10th through February 2nd, featuring some of Bernstein's best-known works, including West Side Story, On the Town, and Jeremiah, with noted artists Jennifer Coe, Joshua Bell, and Philadelphia's Time for Three. Details at philorch.org/Bernstein or 215-893-1999.
Freshly harvested potatoes are a sweet and juicy treat, and one that you can only enjoy if you grow your own. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the basics of potato growing and reveal a no-work trick that allows you to grow them without any digging, plus chemical-free answers to all your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Iowans have a lot on their minds these days.
The economy, the war,
healthcare.
Today, they'll choose which presidential candidates they think will address the issues they care about most. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me and NPR reporters around Iowa to find out the results of the first real contest of the 2008 presidential election. Live special coverage of the Iowa caucuses from NPR News.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Kenyan has been one of the most stable, prosperous, and developed countries in Africa. Violence has broken out after last week's vote and charges of vote rigging and fraud. Now two leaders have claimed victory, incumbent President Mwai Kibaki and his challenger Raila Odinga. Several hundred people have been killed and the crisis is ongoing. We just said goodbye to Joel Barkan. He was an election observer in Kenya. And now we welcome two guests who will be staying with us for the rest of the hour. Chris Fomunya is Senior Associate of Africa Programs at the National Democratic Institute, and that's a nonpartisan organization. They monitor elections and promote democracy worldwide. He's a citizen of Cameroon. Chris Fomunya, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marie. It's nice to be here and a pleasure to be on your show.
Nice to have you on the show. And let me just get our second, or I should say third guest in on the conversation. And that's Frank Holmquist. He's a professor of politics at Hampshire College, where he teaches and writes about Kenyan politics. And Frank Holmquist, nice to have you with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Chris Fomunya, let me begin with you. And we talked with Joel Barkan, who was in Kenya as an election observer. Where do you see this crisis going?
Well, it's unfortunate that the crisis has gone through a number of very dramatic days when we've seen hundreds of lives being lost. But I get the sense that because everyone is now seized with finding a way out, that the Kenyans, civic leaders in Kenya are trying to work through a compromise. Africans, including such notables as Desmond Tutu of South Africa, are now involved. The African Union is involved. European partners, the U.S. government is also making calls. So my hope is that in the next few days, we may begin to see cooler heads prevail and a negotiated settlement out of the current crisis.
Frank Holmquist, where do you see this crisis going?
Well, I agree with Chris. I think the big problem when society and polity are facing such deep divisions as this is how to gain trust again. And that takes a while, and it takes sort of measured steps. But I think everybody is simply appalled by the violence that has occurred, and they fear that, in fact, it could get worse, that something has to be done as time passes, lest the tensions, the divisions become even more, the divide becomes a chasm.
Well, and just picking up on what you just said, I was wondering about, you know, whoever is officially declared the winner of this election, what's the challenge then to governing Kenya and dealing with this violence that's been unleashed? I'm back to you, Frank Holmquist.
Surely. We're in new territory here. I mean, surely there is a lot that the world has learned about sort of post-conflict societies that may be relevant here. It isn't my arena in particular, but there are ways in which one has to go very methodically, I think, about sort of dealing with real divisions and real pain in different parts of Kenya.
And I guess to you, Chris Fomunya, that the same question, which is, what's the challenge to whoever becomes the president? And of course, there's a parliament as well. But what's the challenge then to governing Kenya after this political crisis?
Well, I think it really depends on the basis on which that new foundation will be laid, in the sense that if at the end of this process there's a sense that the rightful winner has been declared or is being accepted by Kenyans or some Kenyans and the international community, that individual would have the legitimacy that's needed to begin a genuine process of peace and reconciliation. On the other hand, if the controversy continues and there's no clarity as to who was the rightful winner of the election, it would become very difficult, even for the incumbent president, to be able to assert his authority and to be accepted by a vast majority of Kenyans.
And I guess a challenge for any democracy, especially a young democracy like Kenya, is this transfer of power, either power sharing or moving from one leadership to another. Chris Fomenyo, do you want to speak to that?
Yes, because, you know, for most African countries that had independence in the 60s, for the first two or three decades of independence, we scarcely had elections that resulted in political power being turned over to the opposition through the electoral process. And so it's just in the late 90s, as democratization has begun to take root, as one-party regimes have ended on the African continent, that we've had competitive elections and have seen a shift of political power through the electoral process. Fortunately for Kenya, in 2002, when Kibaki came into power, he and Raila Odinga, who were allies at the time,
that's right,
were part of a broad coalition that campaigned for change because they wanted to get the KANU, the party that had ruled the country since independence, out of power. And they did succeed in achieving that change of political power. And there was a lot of hope amongst Kenyans and friends of Kenya that the 2007 elections would build on the successes of the 2002 transition in a way that will continue to strengthen and consolidate democratic institutions in Kenya. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case today.
But do you think, Frank Holmquist, that these two allies who are now opponents, maybe even enemies, can be brought together?
Yeah, I think so. That as Joel was saying, I mean, these are politicians who have been allied with a whole range of forces over their own sort of personal political histories, forming coalitions and dissolving coalitions and making new ones is not new to them. But the new government or the new dispensation, whatever it's going to be, is going to have to be inclusive. It's going to have to be rather carefully put together.
Yeah,
Could
I just add here that I agree with Frank, except that there's a little caveat, because when the coalition between incumbent President Kibaki and Raila Odinga, the opposition leader, fell apart in 2000, it came to a head in 2005 when Kibaki tried to push through a series of constitutional amendments that would have given more power to the president's office. And Raila Odinga campaigned against that. And so if that's some kind of power-sharing arrangement today, it could be very difficult to see those two individuals working hand-in-hand, especially if there wasn't clarity as to who actually won the elections of last week.
And I wonder to you, Frank Holmquist, and we heard from Joel Barkin and from others that there was, and certainly by American standards, an extraordinary turnout, maybe 70%, maybe 90% in some regions of Kenya. Does that tell you, though, that the Kenyan people, as much as they might be concerned and frustrated by what's happening today, actually believe in democracy or believe in the vote?
Yeah, definitely. What's striking about the polls that have gone out across the African continent, but also Kenya, is how strongly people believe in and sort of desire democracy, and they do so for many reasons, but perhaps the major one is simply the fact of rights and of freedom. In some ways, there's even more confidence in democracy than some parallel polls I've seen for Latin America and so forth. So part of the anger that's being expressed in rather painful ways, to mm-hmm. be sure, is a result of the fact that people really are devoted to this process, and the fact that Kenya appeared to be moving in a more positive direction, and suddenly that seemed to be dashed.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Frank Holmquist. He's a professor of politics at Hampshire College, where he teaches and writes about Kenyan politics. Also with us, Chris Fomenyo, Senior Associate of Africa Programs at the National Democratic Institute, and that's a nonpartisan organization. They monitor elections, promote democracy worldwide. He's also a citizen of Cameroon, and we are discussing the volatile situation in Kenya today following elections last week. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Alex from Jenkintown to join us this morning on Radio Times. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marie.
You're welcome.
Great show.
Thank
timely.
You. Thank you.
It's sad that we've lost lots of lives in Kenya.
Yes.
My comment was that in regarding post-conflict situation in Kenya and more generally future elections, there will be incumbent on the parties involved, both the opposition and the current president, in terms of the one who was re-inaugurated in a questionable way. that they build institutions that are credible. Kenyans are thinking as much as their guests are saying, believe in democracy and believe in electoral processes, have deep disregard for sort of the legal systems and tend to lynch common criminals, for instance, as a way of, instead of waiting for the legal processes. And so it's not unusual that they would vent their anger against the government using, you know, crude methods such as burning people and cutting each other up. But I believe that a future that is sustainable in Kenya will depend on creation of credible institutions that function effectively.
Well, Alex,
that's a function of time.
Sure, indeed, and it's a good question. I appreciate the call. Let me get a response from Chris Fomenyo. As someone who works monitoring election, promoting democracy worldwide, do you agree with Alex that it's important to build these institutions that have some constituency base?
I think Alex has a very valid point about the significance of institutions in strengthening and supporting democratic societies. But the dilemma that we face oftentimes is that you need leaders to put those institutions in place. And if you don't have leaders who are Democrats at heart and who have a vision for the country, they're not going to be willing to put in place viable institutions that can sustain the democratic process in their respective countries. And so that's one reason also why elections are extremely important, because they are the one social compact that's negotiated between citizens and those that govern them in public view. And a government that steals an election or gets into power through an electoral process that's not viewed as legitimate has a hard time or the getting the willingness to put in place and the political will to put in place institutions that can really last and sustain the democratic process.
And to you, Frank Holmquist, yeah. What we read about Kenya under the government of Kibaki, which is what Kibaki was, that the economy was really going well, tourism had returned, which of course means a lot of money to Kenya. But at the same time, many people's living status had not improved under this government, and there are problems of corruption.
That's right, and impunity, in a sense, at the top reigned, and it's a continuation of a process under the prior president. And poverty really can't be, perhaps, in the very short run, but I think it's fair to say it hasn't been fundamentally dented in the last
right.
5 years.
Right.
But just to go to the issue of institutions, again, I think Chris is right. Part of the creation of institutions, however sort of murky and mysterious it is in a sense developing a kind of very dense sort of political, excuse me, and popular-based politics that elections can foster. They don't guarantee it, and somehow you have to have sort of a politics between elections. You have to have a popular sort of voice and leverage on a system between elections, and this renting of the fiber that's going on now is going to make that more difficult for Kenya. One has to sort of acknowledge that, that civil society, in fact, will be divided in terms of different loyalties, however quietly spoken and so forth. The Electoral Commission is clearly deeply compromised. The church leaders even have not been as vocal as one might have expected, or, for example, as they were when it was a sort of a grand duality under the prior president of sort of that president versus everyone else in a way, at least those in civil society organizations. And the churches collectively were quite vocal. So all I'm saying is that this kind of infrastructure of the populace is going to be hurt by this. It doesn't mean it won't come back, because there's a tremendous amount of energy in Kenyan civil society to repair these divisions, but I think it'll take a bit of time.
Let me put to you, Chris Fomenyo, something that I've heard and read, I'm sure you have as well, making some parallels between Kenya and Rwanda. The incident that's pointed to is this burning of the church, where apparently as many as 50 people were burned to death. And then I see something in Reuters, the President Mwai Kibaki talking about genocide in Kenya. This is a quote: "It's becoming clear that these well-organized acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing were well-planned, financed, and rehearsed by Orange Democratic Movement leaders prior to the general elections." And this was read by one of the government ministers, raising the question about whether this was a planned attack on his followers. Are you concerned that Kenya could begin to look like Rwanda?
I think on the one hand, one has to be concerned every time people start throwing around the kind of rhetoric that only inflames an already very explosive situation. It was disheartening to learn about the loss of lives and to see images of people wielding machetes in the air, which would only bring back memories of what happened in Rwanda in 1994, and that's very sad. But on the other hand, one has to acknowledge that Kenya is a more diverse society. In Rwanda, you had two main ethnic groups that were very opposed to each other, whereas in Kenya, while the Kikuyus are a majority ethnic groups, and that's the ethnic group to which President Kibaki belongs, the Luos are part of many are one of many other ethnic groups that are not currently at the realm of political power in Kenya. And so it's a more diverse society than was the case in Rwanda. It's also a society in which people have begun to identify along business interests, commercial interests, and other professional interests, other than was the case in Rwanda at the time, where because of the primary activity was agriculture, people tended to stay attached to their primary lines of affiliation, which would be the ethnic basis. So I do have some concerns, but hopefully I don't think Kenya would get to that point where we could see a full-blown genocide. But the fact that political actors and their surrogates are throwing around such words, I don't think would help in the healing process that Kenya needs to go through to bring an end to the violence and to put the country back on track.
And Frank Holmquist, how deep is the resentment of the Kikuyu?
Well, I mean, it's there and it's not there, and it's one of these things that different identities make up every person, and sort of different identities are brought out for different occasions. And the reality of Kikuyus in much of Kenya is that they are the small businessmen outside of their sort of home areas. So that means that they sort of act as buffers in a global economy in a way which can be a rather painful and difficult situation at times. So the Kikuyu are seen as being, you know, good businessmen but sharp, that kind of thing. And so there's the perception or representation of the Kikuyu as small businessmen that, in a sense, is also all over the country. But like Chris says, everybody, there's a kind of complexity to the ethnic equation in Kenya, which can also be useful to avoid this kind of radical dualism that occurred in Rwanda.
And we're almost up on a break here, but are you also saying to American audiences, be careful how you use the word tribal or ethnic when talking about Kenya?
Yes, this is really quite important, because the word tribe means something very different than it here than it means in Kenya. And yes.
Okay, sorry about that. We just have to take another short break, get back to our guests and also back to our callers. That's Frank Holmquist. He's a professor of politics at Hampshire College. He teaches and writes about Kenyan politics. Chris Fomenyo, a senior associate of Africa programs at the National Democratic Institute. He's a citizen of Cameroon. And we invited both of them to join us today on Radio Times to talk about the volatile situation in Kenya following elections last week. And we do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. 8477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston. In his new book, Free Lunch, he reports on how the rules affecting who wins and who loses economically have been quietly and subtly rewritten over the past three decades to favor the rich, the powerful, and politically connected. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day. In war-torn Liberia, women are often the victims of violence. Now, women are fighting that violence as part of the UN's first all-female peacekeeping force.
Before, women didn't want to join the police. There was a lot of corruption. But now women are looking at it that we can make a difference.
That story next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Marshalltown, Iowa was home to a major immigration raid a year ago. How do residents feel on caucus day? Also, exploring family history through DNA analysis can raise more questions than answers. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Talking about Kenya today on Radio Times with our guests Frank Holmquist and Chris Fomenyo. We've got Henry from Willingboro joining us this morning on Radio Times. Henry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you, Marty, for letting me come on the air.
Sure.
First of all, I'll try to address like three issues that I'm listening over the radio that's been going on in Kenya. With the ethnic violence, we have to know that it's not a Luo Kikuyu thing. This thing was staged between one tribe versus the rest of the ethnicity tribes in Kenya. And I think they just had a backlash when these people felt like the Orange Democratic Movement, which is Raila's party, had really won this thing, and Kibaki, who happens to just be a Kikuyu, ended up rigging the elections. That was the problem. But the backlash, you can see, is not a Luo thing or a Kikuyu thing. It's the other ethnicity types who are against Kibaki's tribe, which unfortunately, he happens to be a Kikuyu, that they're taking out their anger on the Kikuyus, but it's just a backlash that Kibaki rigged the elections.
Well, Henry, let me just stop you there, only because we've got some other callers. I want to get in on the conversation, and you've raised an important point. I want to give our guests a chance to respond to that. And Chris Fomenyo, what we hear from Henry is that it's the Kikuyu versus the rest of the people in Kenya, and is from his perspective, he thinks this was a rigged election by the current president. Do you agree, disagree? Do we know the answer to that?
Well, I that's one of the reasons why I was pleased to hear this morning that the Attorney General of Kenya has asked for an independent investigation into what really transpired. And that was heartening to hear, because in the last few days, the opposition candidates have also been asking for an audit. And international observers, as well as domestic observers, ask for a release of the elections polling site by polling site. I mean, these are all steps that would help clarify whether the outcome was rigged or not. And my sense is that the opposition would definitely have evidence to show that they may have actually won this election. And if that were the case, steps would need to be taken to provide the redress that they deserve. Initially, what we've seen in most countries that go through these kinds of challenges and that are going through the democratic transition is that the main issue of dispute around an election has to do with the conduct of the election and the tabulation and announcement of results. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, when things begin to degenerate, when there's a destruction of property and a loss of life, then very quickly things can degenerate into ethnic tensions, or ethnic tensions then come to the fore, which tensions may not have existed prior to the main issue, which was litigation over the outcome of the elections.
And to you, Frank Holmquist, for those people listening to this saying to themselves, you know, why should I care about Kenya? Why should, what does Kenya matter to the United States?
Well, obviously anybody should be concerned about the travail, but to the U.S., I mean, I think the U.S. sees Kenya as a rather pivotal country in Africa, as being center of activity, in a sense, political activity for the Horn of Africa, for Central Africa. Kenya has the most viable, strongest economy. The fact that the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi is the biggest on the continent might have something to say about the
why we look at that country the way
right,
we do.
Right, right. I mean, it may not be an accident.
And the U.S. is terribly concerned now about terrorism activity and so forth. So Kenya for U.S. foreign policy is rather central. I should say that I've been disappointed with the U.S. response, at least initially. It was just, while other countries, other European countries I know, and maybe others were trying to get a more transparent sort of counting out to the public, the U.S. rather quickly came and endorsed the result and then had to backtrack. That kind of response is I think, unfortunate.
And why do you think the U.S. responded that way?
Well, one never knows, of course. But I think it's fair to say, and this is sort of maybe too macro for the moment, but I think when you create a kind of primacy for fighting terrorism, as it's defined, you also offer stability, and sometimes stability in very short-term sense. And I have no idea if that's a calculation at the moment, but one shouldn't be surprised that concerns for stability will come out as the U.S. or any country is concerned about governments that may not have a firm control internally or certain elements within those countries that may be a problem for the U.S.
Let me get you, Chris Womenio, to respond to that as well. How do you see the U.S.-Kenya relationship?
Yes, I think it's a very important relationship, and it's really important for people in the United States to care about Kenya for a number of reasons. I'll take just three very quickly. First of all, Kenya is the most viable business hub in all of East Africa. And so things that happen in Kenya would affect economies all the way from Egypt down to South Africa and the countries in between. Secondly, the point that Frank raised about the anti-terrorism struggle, Kenya has been a close ally of the United States in the global fight against terrorism. And we must remember the embassy bombings in Nairobi as well as in Dar es Salaam, neighboring Tanzania, in 1998-99. And also, Kenya has so far been a firewall, a bulwark kind of state, because it shares boundaries with Somalia, which is a failed state, also with Sudan, which has problems in Darfur and, you know, not too long ago in southern part of Sudan. And so if Kenya falls or if Kenya becomes ungovernable because a vast majority of Kenyans question the legitimacy of the government of the day, I think it would really impact U.S.-Africa relations.
Do you think, though, Chris, that there's something more that the U.S. should do? Should the U.S. stand on the sidelines and support the negotiation or mediation efforts that are apparently underway?
I think it's not just a question of standing on the sidelines. I think it's a question of being upfront and being very clear in terms of where the U.S. government stands, because you can't afford, when there's a crisis of this nature, to be ambivalent about your desire to see democracy prevail and to have the voices of the Kenyan people heard. You also cannot allow for legitimacy to be superseded by short-term considerations of stability, which Frank alluded to, because after all, there's no reason to imagine that the next government that comes out of this electoral process that is viewed as legitimate by the people of Kenya wouldn't also work hard to have the same kind of relationships that the previous government has had with the United States.
And to you, Frank, and then we'll get back to our callers, do you think the United States looks at Kenya as an equal?
In what sense?
Well, that we are, you know, equal countries in the world, or I guess the reason I ask that is just because of Kenya's history as a you know, part of the colonial British Empire, and whether the U.S. sees this as a country equal to the United States and treat it, I guess, with the kind of respect that one treats equals.
Well, I think the U.S. and Kenya have had a rather close relationship over a long period of time. The character of that relationship has changed. The U.S. was instrumental in sort of helping to sort of break the back, if you like, of the prior Moi regime and its one-party state, when the U.S. basically, along with others, pulled out or questioned an aid program back in 1990, rather quickly the political system was opened up. We had an ambassador who was quite critical of the rather repressive features of that prior regime, So the U.S. has played a role, but I should say prior to that, mm-hmm. during the Cold War, I think it's fair to say we weren't terribly critical of some of the trends going on that we later decided to criticize. And it was only the end of the Cold War that, in a sense, quote-unquote, allowed the U.S., I think, and other countries sometimes to play a more critical and, I think, useful role. But the point is that the U.S. has seen Kenya as very important. And the relationship, by and large, has been rather positive over recent years.
Well, let's get back to our callers. And we do have just a couple open lines. And we're curious if you are Kenyan living in the U.S. and you have family in Kenya that you've been talking to, perhaps even talking to over the Internet, do give us a call here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We've got Carolyn from Collegeville joining us. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I live in Philadelphia, and I'm Kenyan. I've been following the situation closely, and I've been very concerned.
I'm sure you are.
I have family members who are living in the areas where there's fighting going on, and they've been displaced.
Do you know where they are, Carolyn? Do you know where your family is?
In Eldoret, mm-hmm. in a town called Eldoret, and they've been displaced. And my concern is that the opposition, where the opposition is pretty strong in that area, is not calling to an end of violence. And the opposition leader says that, he cannot put an anesthesia on the situation, and that, the blood has to flow. And I wonder what kind of leadership, what's going to happen to our country.
Sure, and your family members as well. I think that was Chris who I heard responding to your call there, Karen. Let me see what Chris Fomenyo has to say.
Yeah, Carolyn is right that Eldoret, the town where her family is based, is one of the cities that's been hardest hit by the destruction of property and the loss of life. And it's very unfortunate. In fact, Carolyn's point really underscores what's being said by a number of Kenyans today who are getting together and saying, you know, we shouldn't allow a few leaders to really destroy the fabric of the country. And hopefully when voices such as Carolyn's and others begin to speak out, that hopefully would bring the leaders to reason. I was kind of delighted to see today that the rally, the 1 million march that 1 million man march that the opposition had planned to organize in Nairobi was called off, and I think that would lower the temperature a little bit, but hopefully it should allow for the ongoing interventions or mediation efforts to kind of take root.
And Carolyn, before we say goodbye, where is your family today? Do you know?
We are not able to get through because they don't have any more their telephone cards. They use prepaid cards.
Sure.
They can't get anywhere. They can't get them anywhere. And then this calling of political rallies, I mean, now the opposition leader has said there's going to be another rally next week on Tuesday, and that's just putting everybody that can't go to work. Everything's at a standstill. I don't know why he can't wait to negotiate.
Well, Carolyn,
instead of just heightening all these situations, making things worse.
I hear you, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Frank Holmquist has to say. Frank, go ahead.
I think Carolyn brings up the reality of displaced people now, and the displaced people need assistance. And for those Americans and others who want to be of help, I think it's incumbent on us to sort of pay attention to that, because the Kenyan Red Cross, for example, which I'm not that familiar with, but I think it's kenyaredcross.org, will certainly need help because this has happened so quickly. Already there are people fleeing into Uganda and so forth in the West. So I think it's important just to think ahead a little bit about the immediate aftermath of the violence in various places. There are these displaced people, and they have nothing, and they deserve help.
Carolyn, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get to Doreen from Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Doreen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling to comment about the situation in Kenya. I've been watching CNN, BBC, and mm-hmm. all fingers seem to be pointing at Raila Odinga. But what about the Kibaki's government, because he's the one who is fueling all of the problems?
So you blame the Kibaki government?
Yes, I do, because like today, there was supposed to have a peaceful demonstration, and the people won't even be let to come into the city. Mm. The police are being ordered to fire tear gas at people who are not even fighting. They're just wanting to march to Uhuru Park.
But interestingly, Doreen, our guests were saying that I can't remember if it was you, Frank, or you, Chris, that said you thought it was a good thing that this protest was called off, just to kind of diffuse the situation.
No.
Was that you, Chris?
I just have that for the radio, but I don't think it's a good thing because I think that people are being oppressed. There's no democracy. They're just angry and they want to come and air their views.
Doreen, let me get Chris to respond to that.
Yeah, you know, that's always the dilemma when you find yourself in a crisis mode, and especially when lives are being lost. And I think the first instinct is to try to preserve human life and to avoid incidents that could spark further violence. And this doesn't mean that, you know, the opposition doesn't have a right to reclaim or to seek redress, but steps should be taken to not further expose citizens who are already at risk. It's really a contradictory image to see Kenya today that has been host to displaced persons from Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, even the Great Lakes region, and today we now see Kenyans escaping across the border into Uganda and Tanzania and other countries, and it really breaks my heart as an African, and what is happening in Kenya today would have ramifications across all of the continent.
Doreen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I'm looking at the clock here. Unfortunately, we can't take more callers. But to both of you, and I'll start with you, Frank Holmquist, what then will you specifically be looking for, let's say, over the next week to 2 weeks?
Yeah, can I just follow on the prior caller? That I think there really are two principles for action in a way, and I think Kenyans sort of understand this as well. That on the one hand, the violence has to be stopped. As long as that continues, it just makes the divisions in the society even broader. Let alone the obvious horror of the violence itself. But secondly, one has to also keep an eye on justice on finding principles that, in fact, can jog the principles to see, to, in a sense, climb down from extreme positions. And that's why I think looking at the vote tallies is one way to do that, because both sides might find out that they were a little bit wrong on that, and there's a kind of reality check that the country needs right now, a kind of benchmark around which then people can begin to talk.
And Chris Fomenyo, I'm giving you the last word. What will you be looking for?
Well, I would be looking for efforts that can really lead to the root causes of the violence and contention over the electoral outcome, that we find a way to dig deep to find the legitimate an outcome that will be viewed as legitimate by the Kenyans, and not simply sweep things under the rug under the guise of a government of national unity, because then that would perpetuate these kinds of conduct in the future.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you both very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Chris Fomenyo, thanks so much.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Frank Holmquist, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we have been talking about Kenya, and the program Radio Times is produced by Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, and Susan Greenbaum. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Find out more about the program, and you can leave us an email there. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the show. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.